guests who are currently organizers within the Asian American community, and we'll talk about the sort of vision of directions in which to go. So, without further ado, as listeners know, there have been many changes in this last week here in WBAI. The interim station manager, Valerie Van Eisler, was fired along with the program director, Bernard White, and Sharon Harper, a producer. There's been a certain analysis that this is largely an internal matter. And yes, there were some serious internal tensions, and I imagine some steps needed to be taken. But the way that these steps were taken, in the middle of the night, changing locks, setting out court orders that the producers like Bernard, who had been working here for 20 years, would be arrested if they set foot in the premises, all of this sets a very dangerous precedent and will definitely leave a long-term residue of distrust and fear. However, the other aspect of this issue is that all of this was done at the behest of the National Board of Pacifica. So that is actually the facet that I would like to explore in today's program. It really is in some ways a battle over the ideological direction of Pacifica, and this is the issue that I have asked the first two guests of this program to discuss. So the guests that I have are David Adelson. David, are you there?
I am.
Hello, David. David is a chair of the local advisory board of KPFK, which is a Pacifica station in Los Angeles. And he's also a plaintiff in a lawsuit that was filed by local boards against the National Board for Disenfranchisement. We also have Sam Husseini. Sam, are you there?
I am.
Excellent. Sam is the chair of the local advisory board of WPFW, which is the Washington, D.C. Pacifica station. And he's also communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. We have Vijay Prashad. Vijay?
Hi, good evening, Anirudh.
Hi, good evening, Vijay. Great that you could make it. Vijay is a professor of international relations at Trinity College in Hartford. He is the author of a book called Karma of Brown Folk and has been very active in organizing at a number of levels in the Asian American community in and around New York. And in studio, we have Biju Matthew. Hi, Biju.
Hello, how are you doing, Anirudh?
And Biju is a professor at... Ryder College, sorry. I'm blanking out for a moment. Ryder College here in New Jersey, and is has also been active for a number of years in movements in the city. So let's start with this issue, David. And one thing which has been put forward, an idea that has been put forward by a number of people on the National Board, is that stations like WBAI represent all that is anachronistic, that Pacifica is just a shadow of its former self and needs to be brought forward. There's a quotation from Kenneth Ford, the vice chair of the board of Pacifica Foundation, in last Saturday's New York Times, namely, Pacifica has gone from being insignificant to irrelevant. Do we serve people who are locked in time in the 60s, or do we try to stay current and expand? Would you like to comment on this idea of Pacifica being irrelevant and unimportant?
I'd like to, very much. Before I do, though, I wanted to correct one thing. You said that the lawsuit was brought by local advisory boards, and it was actually brought by a number of local advisory board members acting together rather than by those boards.
That's an important question.
Also important to say that when I'm here, I'm speaking on behalf of myself and on behalf of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, not on behalf of my local board. So with that, I wanted to turn the question around and ask your listeners, because Pacifica was created to be a place where the people who were at the mics were addressing themselves to individuals in the audience, not a mass of consumers. So let's turn the question around and ask your listeners, you who are in your car or in your living room or wherever you happen to be, if somebody says that the programming on WBAI is irrelevant, I ask the question, are they saying that you, to whom this programming matters, are irrelevant? And that's really one of the things that's at the heart of this whole thing, which is, are the people who depend upon the kind of programming that you do, are they of any importance in the decision-making that's going to happen at Pacifica about the programming? And if so, via what means are they of importance? We can get into some of the structural issues and the the history of how decisions got made, but I would like to ask you a question, which is, who is your audience, as far as you understand it? How would you describe some of the people that we're talking to right now?
Well, the audience that has come up most visibly, I suppose, it's true that the audience varies very much from program to program. There is one audience which has been really energized by these recent events in WBAI, and that is, it's a very mixed audience, but it seems to be, I mean, very mixed in terms of any criteria one can think of color, of there are people who are connected with labor groups, but you know, individuals, you know, academics. There are it's just a whole range of groups. There are about 1,200 people who showed up, for example, at this meeting that is being held right this evening, a teach-in talking about this whole issue, and you know, so 1,200 people who were willing to come from all around this area, Connecticut and New Jersey and New York, to listen to the issues around.
So that brings up the point that the relevance, see, the relevance in the way that Ken Ford is talking about it comes from a definition that focuses on your audience as a group of consumers rather than as people who will take what they hear and act on it. Lou Hill, when he created Pacifica, was creating an outlet for people who would take what they heard and go and act upon it, that he was looking to establish a system for ethical communication. And what he said was that when you have a dynamic where people are put in front of a microphone to deliver an audience, basically that's a manipulative relationship, and that people who had substantive things to communicate, artists and thinkers, about the way the world functioned, and in particular about the way power functioned in the world, and very particularly the way power functioned in the United States, that those people would have nothing to do with a radio station whose goal was to maintain audiences of a certain size. He wanted people to be able to address themselves to individuals. Now, what Ken Ford is saying with respect to relevance is it's not relevant because the audience isn't big enough and we don't make enough money. One of the things that many people who have raised this similar criticism have said in the past is, and John Dingus said this in an article in The Nation magazine, and it was echoed by David Giovannoni, who is an audience consultant for Pacifica, is that Pacifica is just a shadow of its former proud self, of its former influential self. But they also say, we are succeeding because Pacifica's audiences have never been bigger. We've never gotten more money from them, and there's never been more of them. So there's a problem there. Because
so there's a contradiction in what they're saying.
Contradiction. The former, it's just a shadow of its former proud self, yet it's never had a bigger audience. So to me, that means that the thing that distinguished Pacifica in the past was the content of its broadcast. And I want to address the thing you said about the conflict at the station and the fact that people came down to involve themselves. Because if they're willing, if you who are listening now are willing to view this as something happening at a distance from you that doesn't really affect you, that won't have any implications for your world, then ultimately you will become irrelevant to that process without finding a way to influence it, to be a participant in what is supposed to be a participatory relationship with the station. And that's difficult. I am concerned about the relevance of the programming.
Right. So really, I mean, you're putting the listeners of Pacifica absolutely right in the forefront as really the major asset, because it's a listenership which is politically articulate, well educated, and really willing to come forward and take to the streets if necessary, or take action as required, depending on what they hear. And therefore, it's actually a very influential station. I mean, there is another aspect to it. That is, there is the fact that the physical plant of Pacifica and the license is expensive. I mean, it's not expensive. I mean, it's very valuable. In about, let's say, 200 million to, I mean, estimates range anything from 200 million to like 400 million.
It could easily exceed that because the New York station and the Berkeley station broadcast in the commercial part of the spectrum. So if they wanted to sell them to a commercial broadcaster, they could get them at commercial rates. And station licenses, particularly station licenses as choices, WBAI, which broadcasts, I believe, from the top of the Empire State Building and has a position in the near the center of the dial, go for hundreds of millions
right.
of dollars.
But in a sense, I mean, that's all, so that it is true that that's a very, you know, something which will make people who think that way, make them see dollar signs, you know, light up their eyes. But in a sense, that is probably secondary. The more important thing is that Pacifica reaches 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 households. Can
well, the signal but, can
yeah,
be
the
picked
signal.
Up by
yeah.
1 in 5 households. But the financial value is just a reflection of the fact, or comes out of the fact, that the broadcast signal can actually influence people's behavior. And there are different models of how you influence people's behavior. One is the commercial model, where you get them into an emotionally reactive state, and you give them messages over and over, and you construct a vision of the world and what's desirable through repetition that influences how they behave. Pacifica's model has always been different. It's to appeal to their intellectual faculties and to address questions of how does my life really work? How does it interact with the overall way the society works? In a way, I mean, people have talked about, well, let's not preach to the choir. But there is an issue of teaching the choir, which is something different.
Absolutely.
And allows the choir to then go and convert the community, as Lynn Geary has said.
Right. So taking that aspect of it, those who are probably concerned about this political reach that Pacifica can have, let us take a look at some of the individuals who are currently on the national board of Pacifica and look at their political affiliations. Sam Husseini, would you like to talk about that?
Well, I actually think that Dave Adelson might be able to better address that.
Okay, well,
let me just point out one or two things on that and then turn it over to him. There is hardly unanimity on the national board, and I think it's a bit of a mistake to say that this is being done at the behest of the national board. I've talked to board members in the last couple of days who are not notified of the actions being taken at WBAI. And for example, Rob Robinson, a board member from the Washington, D.C. area, has a lawsuit pending against the Pacifica, against other people on the board. There are three lawsuits, one by members of the local advisory board, which Dave Adelson is spearheading, one by two of the national board members, Rob Robinson in D.C. and Rabbi Kriegel in Los Angeles, and a third put together by listeners.
Right.
So there is not unanimity on the national board, but I think that Dave might be able to give you a rundown of some of the board members who are not doing what they should be doing.
And whose political vision, anyway, it seems to be at variance with what with the radical vision with which the board, with which Pacifica was founded.
Yes, and I could speak about one, and that is John Murdoch. And he he's not the chair or the vice chair, but it seems fairly clear from my sitting in on meetings that he's calling a lot of the shots. He's currently rewriting the bylaws of Pacifica. He is a lawyer at Epstein Becker Green, which is a corporate law firm, which on its webpage describes itself as working to ensure a union-free workplace. He represents HMOs in litigation. That's his specialty.
On the management side?
On the management side. That law firm is also the law firm of Pacifica, so I'm not sure what the ethics of that situation are.
The law firm of Pacifica represents...
Well, they're representing Pacifica in some of the lawsuits presently against them. There's been attempts to get them disqualified on the grounds of conflict of interest.
Very interesting. So, Dave, would you like to take that on? About
sure. I think what your listeners need to understand is something about the structure of Pacifica, which is there's an executive... Pacifica is the foundation which holds the licenses for the five stations in Houston, Berkeley, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and New York. There is an executive director of Pacifica, And that executive director, as things stand now, is responsible for the hiring and firing of the managers at the five member stations. The managers at each of the five member stations have essentially complete autonomy over the operations of the station, though obviously if they do things at variance with what the national administration wants, they're subject to being removed in the way that Valerie Van Issel was removed, in the way that Nicole Soroya had her contract not picked up in Berkeley. And in both those cases, they sparked uprisings of the staff who understood what was going on as an assault on the autonomy of those staffs. And they also, one reason for the vigor of it was they understood it in the overall political context of Pacifica, in which the governing board has made the basis of all these lawsuits is the governing board has changed its bylaws that it now elects its own members.
We'll go into that in just a second, but why don't we just talk about the complexion.
So Bessie Walsh is the executive director. Now, the power, essentially, to execute things in Pacifica comes about from who are the members of the governing board of Pacifica who are in a position to influence what Bessie Walsh does. Who does she report to? Basically, she reports to the executive committee of the Pacifica board. So executive committee members have a lot of influence. But the core people that I would say are actively driving things are, to a lesser extent now, the departed chair, Mary Frances Berry, John Murdoch, as Sam said, who is a lawyer with a firm who does management side consulting and aids in maintaining a union-free workplace, the treasurer of the board, Michael Palmer, who is a broker for C.B. Richard Ellis, Coldwell Banker Richard Ellis, in Houston. He was the one who sent the infamous letter about the potential sale of KPFA, recommending that they sell WBAI instead because he said they had a more dysfunctional staff and it would be an easier, it had more value and would be an easier thing to sell. There's Ken Ford, who you mentioned, who's the vice chair, who's a member of who works for the National Association of Home Builders, which is a lobbying group for the construction industry.
And who I should say, his term has technically expired.
Correct.
This is one of the procedural irregularities that Rob Robinson and other board members are putting forward in their lawsuit.
But basically at Pacifica they've played rather fast and loose, and the people who were doing things did things as they wanted rather than by the book, and that left them open to a lot of these legal actions.
Right. So let's say to play the devil's advocate, I say, okay, well you've pointed out these people, you've pointed out their rather suspicious political affiliations. Well, what is the evidence that they're actually doing anything that is nefarious in the Pacifica context? I mean, somebody can be a banker, but that doesn't mean that...
Sure.
So what evidence is there?
Sure. Let me just give one more person, which is Bert Lee, a former co-owner of the Denver Nuggets basketball team, who has made a lot of money in the buying and selling of radio stations along the way. And you're absolutely right. Somebody's profession doesn't necessarily damn them. I would say that the Palmer email... there was a misdirected email that Michael Palmer, the treasurer, he was then treasurer-elect, sent to Media Alliance by accident that had been intended to go to the chair, Mary Berry. That's the sort of most obvious smoking gun, this discussion of the sale of stations in order to get rid of obstreperous staff and realize a profit on, well, excuse me, not realize a profit, but liquidate the asset so that that asset gets to be at the disposal of the national board itself. I guess my greatest problem with what's gone on has been this mass reconfiguration of the broadcasting operations of Pacifica over the last 5 years by people who had no role in building that $500 million worth of value. They're now claiming that they uniquely should have the right to decide what happens. But Pacifica was built by the support of its listeners and the activity of its staff over many years. And the history is that the governing board never really had leverage over operations, quote, on the ground, if you will.
Yes. I mean, further evidence of nefarious activities is just looking at their statements and what they hold up as the model. For example, I used to live in New York. And while I certainly have my problems occasionally with WBAI, I thought that it was attempting to be quite relevant in terms of being a tool for the community and a source of real information. I was shocked when I came here to Washington, D.C., WPFW plays about 85% jazz. This is the nation's capital, and there is such a tremendous opportunity and such a tremendous need for information, for political relevancy on a whole wide variety of issues. This station has been held up as the model for WPFW by the current national leadership. That's clearly the direction that they're going in, to castrating the political relevancy towards stifling voices like Amy Goodman and others for their you know, progressive, serious perspectives, and driving out professionals. I mean, they want to be NPR in terms of political content, but not in terms of sound quality and professionalism.
Yeah. For example, if I might interrupt. Could you give examples of, for example, the lack of news coverage in the WPFW?
Well, there is no local news at WPFW.
And this is in a station which is right in the capital of the country.
Yeah.
There is, in fact, no. I remember reading that they rarely have any representatives in any of the press conferences at the press club. In fact,
yes, well,
you have representatives like Amy Goodman coming in from New York, but right. Not any local representatives from WPFW.
Just to play the devil's advocate, Pacifica would argue that, well, the reason for that is that we're under-resourced and we have a bunch of flaky volunteers around and we can't do that. And what we're trying to do is increase the funding so that we can establish news departments. For example, the Houston station is just now bringing a news department online. Sam, you might want to mention what happened at the A16 protests against the globalization movement when the folks involved in the mobilization for global justice basically had no access to the station during those massive protests.
Right. I mean, the protests sort of following up from the WTO protests in Seattle, the protests here in D.C., WPFW could have been such a resource for that mobilization and such a source of information for it. And they had absolutely no desire whatsoever to be part of that, either in terms of the organizing of it or even in terms of covering it. Even things like the Million Mom March, the Million Family March, things come and go here in Washington, D.C., and WPFW is just sitting around fiddling. They're playing jazz.
They're playing jazz 80% of the time. Yes, the protests against the death penalty, they're playing jazz. And this, as you say, is being held up as the model by Pacifica.
Basically what they're doing, and they're very clear about it, is promoting an essentially market model of broadcasting. They're moving from a community-based broadcasting that involves any number of people who are active in the community and need to communicate social justice issues, to a model of target market programming where they decide the target market on the basis of whatever. We don't have to even attribute what their political ideals are, but whatever the decision makers' political ideals are, or economic desires or what have you, that's going to determine what market they identify. And the essence of target market programming is you choose a profile of the person you're trying to reach and you try to keep them tuned in for long blocks of time.
If I might add one footnote to that, I mean, Democracy Now, I think, raises a good amount of money for the network. So why are they trying to undermine it?
I can tell you why. The reason is that her audience doesn't match the audience being programmed by the rest of the programmers at the various stations. So it contradicts the goal of establishing, getting people tuned in and keeping them tuned in for long blocks of time. Because in the rest of public radio, the time you spend listening is the best predictor of the amount of money you'll give at pledge time. So if her audience tunes in and tunes out for the rest of the programming, and the other programmer's audience tune out for hers, you've defeated the purpose of what they're trying to achieve. And what I believe they're trying to achieve is a habituation, basically almost an addictive response, like the way people may drink Coca-Cola, to turn on the radio at given times during the day, you listen, you accept what you hear, etc. It's feeding your audience, the people who are listening at this moment as we speak, as consumers, not participants.
Can I come in for a second?
Yeah, go ahead, Vijay.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate how David has framed this, but I actually think that confuses the issue a little bit. The contradiction may not necessarily be between, say, you know, market-driven versus community-driven. Because I think ideology and, you know, things, words like the left shouldn't be left out of this discussion.
Absolutely. No, I
feel like it's not just that, you know, the actions of, say, this board or that neoliberal agency is just based on some kind of, you know, willful belief that, you know, the market will determine things. They are more clever than that. I think that they are trying to do a switch on the left and use words like professionalization, use some of the kind of advertising language of markets to actually make a right-wing turn.
Absolutely.
For these nations.
Absolutely.
We're not progressives, but we play some on the radio.
If
I may interrupt, I do have to announce this is close to the half-hour mark, so this is WBAI 99.5, and in fact, the issues that you're talking about are exactly the segue that I want to use into the automatic question that arises from what we are talking about in these last few minutes. You're listening to a program about the niche, the complexion of Pacifica in the broad sense, and a vision, a political vision that we should have for Pacifica to bring it into this new millennium. So the question is, how did Pacifica get into this current straits where it is willing to so easily digest these ideas of market efficiency and professionalization and use those as ways of diluting political content? David?
By the way, I want to go back to what your other guest just said. In every alienation of common resources throughout history, the claim is always made, we're doing this for market efficiency. Whether it be the enclosure of the commons in England, whether it be the logging of forests, anything like that, the claim is always made, the people who are here and present, who rely on this resource for sustenance of themselves and their future generations, their interests are trumped by the interests of another group of people who are not present and who actually don't care about this particular resource. They're looking for example, lumber for their tables. And that is a very deeply political question, and it has always been disguised in the cloak of greater benefit for a greater body of people who are not themselves present at the moment. And that's always the argument made by the powerful intruder.
Well, David, not always. I would suggest that if at the birth of capital that you start seeing this argument, the first philosopher to enunciate the argument was John Locke.
I'm afraid, Vijay, I don't know whether we want to go into that.
But it's actually important, because it's not a question of, say, you know, every time there's appropriation of public resources, or this is something that keeps happening. This is very much linked to a kind of economic understanding of how, you know, political systems should function.
Agreed. You were asking something very technical about how it happened at Pacifica.
Yes.
And basically what happened was that, first of all, people need to know that it's not just unique to Pacifica. It happened throughout non-commercial broadcasting. In 1992, an article was published by Rachel Ann Goodman, and people can go and find links to all this material at www.radio4all.org/freepacifica, one word. We can say that again later, but there's an article by Rachel Ann Goodman that described a process in 1992 that was sweeping through non-commercial stations throughout the country, whereby station administrations were basically establishing target market programming, pushing out volunteers, pushing out advisory boards, pushing out community participation, going to target market programming. And one of the key architects of that was Lynn Chadwick, who was then president of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, and whose ex-husband was involved in something called the Healthy Station Project, which ran around the stations and established this. The process that Rachel Goodman described in 1992 was something that began to take hold at Pacifica in about 1994 or so. And it was a stereotypic process, and some of the same actors were involved. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting was involved. Lynn Chadwick, who ended up as executive director prior to Bessie Wash, was involved, and who was one of the people who was involved in what happened at KPFA recently. So basically, if you look back at the Gingrich Congress, there were threats of the defunding of public broadcasting. And that was used to get all sorts of public broadcasters to get control of various public broadcasting stations by people who bought into the target market model of value and who had disregard for the political value of those stations in their community. So they were saying, we're going to cut off your funding, and you better learn how to make it on your own. And people, staffs were worried about pay cuts. So they were willing to go along with things that administrations would do in order to up the fundraising. And at all these stations, obviously, the people who were excluded no longer had access to the air, and the people who had access to the air had an interest in what was going on, or in some cases, like at Pacifica, where there's a gag rule prohibiting people from going on the air and talking about internal matters. If you went on the air, you'd only get that one shot, and then you'd be out of there. So there was a situation in which there was no ability of anybody who knew what was happening to communicate it. And the people who were doing this were very clear on the way to go about doing it. The other thing is, at each of the stations, you know, there was always a political, there was always a competition for airtime and the rest of it. So when the national administration, primarily in the person of Pat Scott, who was executive director in the mid-90s, began to establish a series of changes, and, for example, she issued a memorandum to the local board that said, we're about to do a massive reconfiguration. And if you refuse to go along with this, if you are opposed to it, you are advised to resign immediately. If you do not, and if we find that you are doing anything to countermand these policies and directives of the national board, you will be dealt with. So there was an active threat that says anybody who doesn't like what the executive is doing is going to be kicked out. And indeed, that happened. But she was smart enough to do it, you know, one at a time. And they always personalized the issue. So this is about, let's take the current case. This is about Bernard White and what Bernard White has or has not done. Or this is about Amy Goodman and what Amy Goodman has or has not done. And as long as they can make the argument that it's about these specific things, your listeners, the people who are listening now, will say, oh, look, that's just some little fight about, just some internal little political spat over who has control. But the power battle was no longer over who got what programming site. It was control over the entire institution. And with the assistance of a variety of consultants, variety of legal means, et cetera, this reconfiguration proceeded. And the key to it was a change in the bylaws of Pacifica that was effected by the governing board last February 99, where they gave themselves the right to elect their entire membership. Prior to that, local boards had elected two-thirds of the available seats on the national board. But it was a very tenuous form of control because people would be elected by the local boards, they'd go up to the national board, and then they'd be in one of two camps. Either you were in with the people who had control over the levers of power, and therefore you got access to information and you could participate, or you were opposed to it and you were excluded from knowing anything that was going on. You're instantly marginalized. So you had people who were driving what was going on and people who were more or less bewildered or trying to figure out a way to enter into the argument somehow, but they never had any purchase. And that's the essence of the Robinson and Kriegel suit that that Sam Husseini mentioned. So what people have to realize is when they hear on the radio somebody get on and say, oh, there's nothing wrong, this is of no importance, oh, it's a minor question, it's a flat-out lie. This is control, a question of control of the largest independent, that means not corporate or state-controlled, broadcast entity in the United States, if not the world, that broadcasts on a weekly basis to 800,000 or so, give or take a couple hundred thousand, of the politically most active people and most conscious people in the entire country. This is not no big deal or just an internal matter. The struggle's really happening, but it had been kept out of the limelight long enough, and one of the ways it was kept out of the limelight was by an argument that said, we're doing this to increase relevance because the programming has become irrelevant. And the evidence of the irrelevancy was that when you take a, you know, when purges happened, when, for example, some of your listeners may remember that they used to receive a station folio that described what was going on at the station and what the programming would be. That was wiped out at all five stations. That was the substrate for communication between the stations and the listeners. Wiped out. When that happened, you had a few isolated cries here and there, but no ability for people to link up and see the shape of the entire process as it was moving forward. Unless they had happened to read in the Whole Earth Review Rachel Ann Goodman's piece on what had happened throughout non-commercial broadcasting, or unless they happened to be hooked into some community broadcasting in a direct way.
So that's really how it happened, in my view.
We do want to, and this again is a segue to the next part of what we can do about it. So we're listening to David Adelson, who's the chair of the local board at KPFK, that is the Los Angeles Pacifica station, and a plaintiff in a lawsuit filed by various individuals against the national board. We also have on the line Sam Husseini, who's the chair of the local board in Washington, D.C. for WPFW, Communications Director for the Institute for Public Accuracy, and Vijay Prashad, who is a professor of international studies at Trinity College. And in studio, we have Biju Matthew, who is a professor at Ryder College and an activist here in the Asian American community in New York City. So, Sam Husseini, would you like to talk about what listeners can do about it? Firstly, what are the various lawsuits or other procedures that are in effect trying to reverse what has been done? What are the ideas being used behind these lawsuits? And primarily, the most important asset, the listeners. What can the listeners do to work in this question?
The most important thing they can do is inform themselves about it and to organize and to try to democratize the institutions. One other good web page in particular is savepacifica.net. If people haven't looked into that, they should. The local advisory boards are part of what the Pacifica Foundation leadership is attempting to do is to disempower the local advisory boards. So people should be going to the local advisory board meetings to try to make sure that the local advisory board is doing all that it can to remedy the situation, to stand up in whatever way it can to Pacifica management and their assault on the basic values of the network. And if the local advisory board is doing that, they should give it its support, and they should be looking at the lawsuits. There are three lawsuits. Some of people will want to inform themselves about that, and these lawsuits are expensive, or some of them are, and people might want to take a look at backing them in some way. They should also be, trying to just simply spread the word. I don't know how much media there's been on this in New York, and to try to get people to pay attention to this, and I'm very heartened to hear that there is quite a meeting, apparently, today of about 1,000 people.
Yeah, well, more than 1,000 people, at least between 1,200 to 1,500 people here in New York City.
I hope people will plug into that. I know that there are a couple of information hotline numbers. I don't have those in front of me, but I'll try to give those out if they haven't already been given out. And they should be forming whatever subcommittees of different support groups and so on. There are several such groups around the Berkeley area in the Bay Area, and that's what led them to back off from their lockout and shutdown of KPFA last year.
So I can give the hotline numbers if you like.
Yeah, please do.
800-825-0055 and 718-707-7189.
So, David, would you like to add?
Please, I'll try to be brief because your other guests are, I'm sure, have a lot to say.
Yes, because what I do want to spend the last 10 minutes on is a sort of idea of the vision of what community radio means.
Okay.
So, yes.
I would say the most important thing that your listeners can do is keep their eye on the prize, not be distracted by, the details of who's doing what to whom are important, but to get it inside them as deeply as they can find it, that the ability to communicate about issues that are of importance in depth is crucial, and it's that ability that's under assault. It would be nice to say, go to this group, go to that group, and do something. The groups are forming, there are these forums, but it's going to be a complex process. And I decided long ago it was worth a lot of my attention and effort, and I hope that some number of the people listening right now will recognize how crucial an institution like Pacifica is and has always been
for all its flaws and warts, and not let themselves be dissuaded from finding a way to make a difference. It's going to take some doing by each one of them. These are just starts. And if people want, there are on the Internet any number of links and sites that people can go to. Free Pacifica is a good place to start, as is Safe Pacifica.
So Free Pacifica and Safe Pacifica. We will spend a couple of minutes right at the end repeating these websites and the numbers. I would request you to do that.
Sure.
But could you spend a couple of minutes talking about the lawsuits and what listeners can do?
Well, the essence of all, at the core of all three lawsuits is the recognition that the bylaws change was illegal. That basically, as long as the governing board has control over its own membership, there's not much anybody can do. We had 15,000 people in the street in Berkeley protesting for free speech, and it was a very difficult thing. That's necessary, but not sufficient. There are other claims as well that they have used foundation funds for things antithetical to the mission of Pacifica. I am a little bit uncomfortable asking for funding support. People can make their own decision when they inform themselves about the lawsuits at the websites. But basically, if it's possible to get a court to recognize that change in bylaws was illegally done and recognize the rights of LABs as members, it will be possible to institute an interim board that would then presumably listen to the demands of various communities. At the time at which that happens, if anybody wants to have a voice in what goes on, it will be important for them to be linked in to the various groups that are doing this kind of work. Also, the listeners' lawsuit, which was brought by Carol Spooner, in which she got the Attorney General to grant them the right to sue on the behalf of the Attorney General's office, essentially.
In California.
That demands that listeners be made members. See, Pacifica is not actually a membership organization. Your listeners are not members of the Pacifica Foundation. They have no voting rights. They have no standing.
In fact, many listeners feel as though they've been fired.
They've been fired, yes, and there's no structural means for them to do anything about it. So they're left with, various kinds of protests or writing angry letters or just being frustrated. And it's the hope of the current administration that they will become frustrated with the difficulty of asserting their interests and will therefore walk away. But there are all sorts of efforts in all sorts of groups in all signal areas to find ways to plug people in so that their voice can be effectively heard. And it may take one or two tries for your listeners to find, for people who make that internal commitment, to find an outlet that's appropriate to the way they like to do work. But you're only going to get a true democratization when the people who care to participate in a meaningful way can find a way to do so. And some of that has to be created through their own creativity.
To mention in passing that Carol Spooner is coming to New York, and she would be, there's a tentative date set January 3rd when she will have a meeting, a largish meeting here, talking about the listener lawsuit. So people who are listening here should mark that date.
And Arundhati, there's a concern that you may not be here next week for allowing this discussion to happen. And one of the preeminent things the people listening to right now, if they value the fact that you were willing to take a courageous stand and do this when it was a threat to your ability to communicate to them in the future, they're going to have to be there for you if that happens.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you very much indeed for saying that. Well, let's spend the last 10 minutes opening up the discussion. Now we've talked about the progressive restriction of the ambit of Pacifica in the name of professionalization, which of course is a red herring, because in the name of professionalization they're getting rid of some of the most professional of the journalists, attacking Amy Goodman, got rid of Vernon Avery Brown, Dan Coughlin, some of the best journalists.
Laura Flanders,
exactly. So some of the best and most professional journalists were actually let go of in the name of professionalization. So let's say, what is the vision of community radio? And maybe here, the two guests who haven't had a chance to talk so far, Biju or Vijay, would you like to start up by what you think a community and community radio should mean?
Biju?
Okay. I think it's what's most important to note here is the whole charge of irrelevancy. I think the central and the most important thing that all of us need to realize is that this is happening precisely because we're getting relevant at this point. You know, the history of the American left movement for the last 20 or 30 odd years is that we're going through a process of rebuilding the left, and Pacifica Network is critical to that process of rebuilding. Now, if there were moments in the past wherein we felt that we were not reaching enough of an audience, the audience wasn't growing far enough, fast enough, then that is itself part of the issue of rebuilding the left. And I think we are at a point wherein we are at a cusp, at a moment wherein we are all set to rebuild the left in a very significant way. And this attack comes at exactly that moment. Now, the central idea, I think, has been kind of articulated in small ways already in the program this far, is this far we've been a listener-supported radio station as a network. It's listener-supported. The whole question is, can we get closer to some notion of a listener-controlled radio station in the sense of direct participation, in the sense of being there, local structures being empowered far more. Now, in connection to that, what I really wish to say is that one of the most specific ways of doing that would be to let a lot of organizations and movement structures that exist in the local area come in and empower the local staff and local station in ways that I think it's probably already started happening up in Berkeley, but it can also happen in every other place. The important thing there is that there are a lot of structures that have now emerged in most of these areas, which are part of the fact that I mentioned that the left is being rebuilt in a very significant way. And if we can allow the energy that is there in that rebuilding left, the momentum that already exists in the process of rebuilding, to come into this process of Pacifica being reorganized for the people, then we'll be really successful. Vijay?
Yeah, firstly, I think the existence of the Asia Pacific Forum is I think the first left Asian program on American radio. I mean, I've looked around, looked through old magazines, etc. I've never found a left program from the Asian community. So I think we should recognize that it's very important. The other thing is, I feel uncomfortable if our fight is only for free speech. I think our fight is for left speech. Because again, if you take the Asian community, there are plenty of Asian radio programs in New York. You know, there are programs that play music forever. There are programs that, tell you some kind of calendar of events for the community. There are all manner of programs that are relatively independent of a kind of corporate control. I mean, they also are a sort of community radio. But they are not left speech. They are, almost along the grain of the local leadership of the community. They are not people, they're not saying things, say, critical of the big community leaders and such. I mean, they're playing as much mesmerizing music. It may not be jazz, but it's mesmerizing music. It's like the Pied Piper leading us all off to some kind of devastated Hamlet of the future.
I
don't think that the fight is necessarily just for...
Not just to a devastated future, maybe leading us into the sari stores.
Okay, the sari stores. Which is a devastated future,
and
by the
spice stores.
kind of terrifying future.
It's pacification.
Pacifica.
It's pacification. What they're gunning for is an audience that will remain passive and will interpret social activism as writing a check at fund drive time. You hear it all the time. If you want to be making a difference,
write a check.
Support us.
Exactly.
It is a process by which this institution wants its listeners to make the institution powerful, rather than the institution attempting to make its listeners powerful in their own political action.
If we restrict our imagination to just free speech, I think it could be a little dangerous, because there's all kind of speech out there that has plenty of space on the dial. This is an institution of left speech, and Asia Pacific Forum is a left Asian viewpoint, and I think that's important to recognize.
What I want to come in and say in support of what Vijay just said is that the whole idea of left speech And in the process of rebuilding the left, if I may connect the two ideas, I mean, that's exactly what I meant when I said that we need to go to all the grassroots structures that exist that have been rebuilt over the last decade and get them involved in this fight. So what I would say straight away to the listeners is that if they are out there, whatever structures of the left that they are connected to, what you need to do is to find ways of mobilizing within that structure so that we win this battle against the Pacifica being turned into some sort of passivity station.
Arundhati, may I read a quote of Lou Hill's that goes to the heart of what he created Pacifica for? It's very quick.
Go ahead.
Actually, it's from a gentleman named McDonald who was somebody that Hill read. And he said, McDonald concluded in the words of one scholar that something disastrous had happened in his lifetime. This disaster had befallen not only the Nazi Holocaust's many victims, but the entire world, indeed human consciousness. Dwarfed by the bureaucratic state, by modern war, by deterministic ideologies, people were, in McDonald's view, losing the capacity to know what it meant to be human. What made McDonald's take, McDonald drew from a concept that quickly gained enormous currency after the war. Being human, or having a self, required being and communicating directly with other people. What made McDonald's take on this theme distinctly pacifist was his contention that both the modern state and deterministic ideologies like Marxism-Leninism or corporate liberalism coerced and tricked people into not listening to each other and thus into not being human.
I'm afraid we've run right out of time. So thanks very much. We were listening to David Adelson, chair of the KPFK local board and a plaintiff in a lawsuit, Sam Husseini, chair of the local board in WPFW, Vijay Prasad, professor of international relations in Trinity, Vijay Matthew, professor at Ryder College, and thank you very much. I'm Aniruddha Das, your host at Asia Pacific Forum. Tune in to apforum@egroups.com or tune in next Wednesday, 9 o'clock. Thank you very much for listening.
Good night.
All of you. Good night.
Good night.
The sounds of the Asian Dub Foundation.
WBAI in New York, 99.5. Stay tuned for Cat Radio Cafe. This is Cat Radio Cafe, a magazine of the arts and cheese tonight, on listener-sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. I'm Janet Coleman. You?
I'm David Dozier.
You are Janet at this place, playwright.
One more time.
Some echo will rise again. There has been a fall off, most definitely, of Morse code interruptions.
Oh, yeah. Well, some things aren't funny forever.
No. When reality becomes too close to call, it's satire. But I do want to say a little bit about satire in Atlantica. And about this tension that's happening right now, although it's not happening right now, it's kind of peaceful, isn't it? This is all happening on Varick Street. However, I just want to...